today on Against the Grain, The Anatomy of a People's Victory, the courageous, successful struggle to prevent the construction of a massive airport on thousands of acres of forest and fields in western France. I'm CS. Two prominent participants describe the now iconic struggle and their understanding of art, organizing, and commoning coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. They took a stand and they won. They squatted the land. They formed an autonomous zone. They defended 4,000 acres of hedgerows and wetlands, farmland and forest, against police assaults and incursions. And they prevented, with the help of a multitude of allies, the planned construction of a massive international airport near the French city of Nantes. How did they do it? What drove them to defend the area, to stop the airport in the face of often brutal police repression? The Against All Odds story is told in a new pamphlet called We Are Nature Defending Itself, Entangling Art, Activism, and Autonomous Zones. The authors, Isabelle Frémont and Jay Jordan, still live, on the site, a place called the ZAD, short for, in French, Zone to Defend. Frémont is a popular educator, action researcher, and former senior lecturer in media and cultural studies at Birkbeck College, London. Jordan is co-founder of Reclaim the Streets and the clandestine insurgent Rebel Clown Army, and the co-editor of the volume We Are Everywhere, The Irresistible Rise of Global Anti-Capitalism. Isa Frémont and Jay Jordan are also co-coordinators of the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination. 6 weeks ago, an event to celebrate the pamphlet's release was held by the Reimagining Value Action Lab at Lakehead University in Ontario, Canada. The event's host was Lakehead Professor Max Haven, who edits the Vagabonds series of Pluto Press, as a part of which We Are Nature Defending Itself was recently published. Today, we'll present edited portions of that event, during which Frémont and Jordan recounted the years-long struggle to organize and defend the ZAD, and also described how they've come to understand the relationship between art, activism, commoning, and insurrection. Here's Isabelle Frémont.
We're delighted to speak from our yurt here. That is pretty much where the control tower of an international airport could have stood, and this is what we're going to tell you about. This is a book about, we hope, about victory and hope, and we feel that stories of hope are very much necessary at the moment. This book indeed took a long time coming, in years in fact, and that's mostly because we tend to prioritize action over words, and the writing was put on hold many times to put our lives and our bodies in the way of the building of an infernal piece of life-wrecking infrastructure, that is an international airport that was planned for the wetlands on which we are, and as our one of our great ancestors of land occupation and squatting and radical commoning and pamphlet writing, Win Stanley, wrote over 300 years ago, words and writings were all nothing and must die, for action is the life of all, and we feel that it's really important to have that in mind today. The title of this pamphlet, We Are Nature Defending Itself, is even older than the start of the writing, and we actually first saw it in the midst of an action back in 2012, and it was tattooed on the forearm of a comrade in a muddy tear gas field forest just next to here. And she was basically throwing tear gas canisters back at the cops when the French government thought that they could just come with their troops and build their airport. And this is what we're going to tell you about tonight, how they could not. We also first used the slogan for an experiment that we co-facilitated in 2015 with our collective, the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination. And basically the pamphlet tells our story, our very personal version of the story of the lab and our journey to try to really truly entangle art activism and everyday life. And so this is where we've been living since 2016, in this squatted farmhouse called La Rolandière, which is bang in the middle of these 4,000 acres of land that were due for a new airport near Nantes. It's a landscape known as bocage, which is typically made of these small fields with many hedgerows around them. And these were due to be concreted over. This particular bocage is made partly of wetlands. There are 9 springs here that are key to the watersheds, and also made of farmland. We are with our own anonymous cows. It's a project that has been planned since 1963. It was due first to be a base for the Concorde and then aerial Rotterdam. And there were great plans for this massive piece of infrastructure, which was immediately resisted from the very beginning in the 60s by local farmers who understood that it makes no sense to destroy nourishing land to build this kind of infrastructure that only leads to the desertification of the countryside. It's also very important to have in mind that these are lands of resistance and struggle. On this particular region in France, was the territory that saw the birth and development of a movement called the paysans travailleurs, the farmers workers, that denounced the growing proletarization of farmers and were making links with workers. For instance, during the first factory occupation in May 68, which took place near Nantes, the farmers from around here built a network to be able to bring food to the occupying strikers. It is also the region, Brittany is the only region in France that doesn't have nuclear power stations because all the projects were defeated by popular resistance. So it was not a good idea to plan this this airport on these great lands of resistance. The project followed the whims of markets and politicians and kind of went into dormancy for quite a few years, but it got taken out of the cardboard boxes in the year 2000 when the government relaunched the project, and the resistance reactivated immediately, but expanded this time beyond just farmers. And a lot of local residents joined and developed mostly legal resistance through using laws about endangered species, laws to protect water, etc. The airport was obviously due to be a green airport, and one of the most interesting maybe dimensions of this green airport was described in the brochure by the architects. They said that there would be a vegetated roof that would merge so well in the surrounding landscape that it would look like a side of the bocage that would rise up. The bocage indeed did rise up, but not quite in the way that they had expected. In 2009, there was really a turning point in the struggle where, inspired by climate camps in the UK, some people came back with the idea and organized a climate camp on the site in Notre-Dame-des-Landes, very, very near where we're sitting right now. And during this climate camp, there was an open letter that had been written the year before by local residents who had grown a bit fed up with the lack of direct action of the state of the struggle at the time, but most importantly had realized that the government was buying land and farms to make way for the airport, and therefore was emptying the territory. And in their letter, they said, to defend a territory, you need to inhabit it. And basically invited people to come and squat land and farms to be able to really give a new boost to the resistance. And that's at the end of the climate camp, when the tents and the marquees were packed up, a few dozen people answered to the invitation and stayed. And this is really where the slogan "Against the airport and its world" came into life. What is interesting is that ZAD is actually a hack, and it's the hack of a planning term. ZAD is an acronym that means zone aménagement différé, a zone where the development is going to be happening later. And so that means that the territory is earmarked and nothing much happens because it needs to be left for further development. The irony is that on these 4,000 acres, one of the things that did not happen because it had been earmarked as a ZAD for the airport was what we call in French the remembrement, i.e. the destruction of hedgerows to make way for industrial agriculture. That didn't happen. And when basically in 2009, the climate camp turned into the ZAD, it became the zone à défendre, no longer the zone à aménagement différé. And it was the beginnings of what would become this world famous autonomous zones where people started to build huts and tree houses, some that were more punk and some more futuristic. There were floating cabins on lakes, many that were entangled with the 222 kilometers of hedgerows that form the blockage here. And what they also did was to actually make links with local farmers, not always in very easy ways. It can't be said that it was plain sailing, but making links to begin to farm and produce in the way of the airport. As you can imagine, that was not seen in a very positive light by the government, who in 2012, on the 16th of October 2012, launched a massive military operation to evict the squatters. It was called Operation Caesar, which in the land of Asterix was also rather a strategic mistake. And basically, when the thousands of cops descended, they were faced with a resistance that was more diverse and more determined than anyone had expected. And when they turned up, they basically didn't know whether they would be faced with burning barricades or old age pensioners singing peace songs to them. There was really quite full-on conflict to more non-violent resistance to treehouse evictions. Mud was a great ally during that very wet winter. There was very good slingshot actions, and there was also the demonstration of one's vulnerability through showing naked bodies to the lines of Robocops and all the way to some good old Viking resistance. Despite that extraordinary resistance, 12 farmhouses and collectives were destroyed within a matter of days. But something else happened in the blockage at that time, something that was very unexpected, and that is the coming together of different forces that were not supposed to come together. And that really came to light on the 17th of November 2012. There had been a call out that had been produced more than a year before that had said, if they evict, we'll come back exactly a month later and rebuilt what has been destroyed. And at the time, Jay and I were living an hour away. And when we saw that call out, we had been involved in the resistance against the evictions. And when we saw that call out, we thought, well, obviously, it's very important to take part. We will go, but it's very likely that it will be small. It's like everyone will be exhausted. Most of the attention will be put on anti-repression. We'll build a symbolic cabin, and that'll be it. That's not quite what happened.
40,000 people came, and many of them were organized groups with pre-built cabins in tractors. Lots of cabins were built this weekend with an amazing energy. Lots of people say it was the most beautiful day of my life. We were sharing an intense moment, so unexpected. On this day, we really had the impression we would win against this awful project. Every morning at 6 o'clock, we were on the barricades, masked and ready to do I don't know what. Personally, for example, I didn't know how to resist, but I was there. For many, many people, it was like that. They didn't came the first day, they didn't came the second day, they didn't came the third day. On the Friday morning at 6 o'clock, the police came. They destroyed the cabins we had built. they also began to stop the work in La Châtaigne, which is a village we had built for this demonstration.
The cops tried to attack, not having understood that when you have 40,000 people who have built this together, they're gonna have even more motivation to defend it. The tension really, really rose. For 3 days, there were loads of offensive grenades being used, flashballs, and thousands of cartridges of tear gas. More than 100 people got injured, and then the government realized that they were about to kill someone, and the government had been in place for not long enough for them to take the risk of killing someone, so they withdrew. Pretty much since 2013, the cops haven't set foot on the zone.
And this is a nod to the Zapatistas. It actually says, you are entering a free territory. Here, the people decide. Because basically, for 6 years, it really became an extraordinary laboratory of commoning, where cops didn't set foot, where institutional interventions did not have their place, and that gave rise to the most extraordinary flurry of creativity. It was really a place where it was possible to try to take one's everyday life into one's own hands.
That's the voice of Isabelle Frémont speaking at a recent event about a new pamphlet she and Jay Jordan have written entitled We Are Nature Defending Itself, Entangling Art, Activism, and Autonomous Zones, published by Pluto Press in collaboration with the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We continue with more of Frémont's remarks.
At its peak, there were 70 squatted living collectives, more than 400 people, and an incredible diversity of activities, from vegetable growing to cereal growing, sheep and cows herding, a blacksmith, forestry activity, cheese making, a library, pirate radio, rap studios, several bakeries, you name it, it was there. And it was really there that we realized and we really experimented that when you have to organize your own shared life, then you have to put it and you have to give it all your attention. And for us, that is what art is really paying attention. And it was on the ZAD that we truly experimented the development of a technique of life, what Michel Foucault has called this art of living, where he said, couldn't everyone's life become a work of art? Why should the lamp or the house become an art object, but not our life? And when that becomes possible, the violent separations of the modern start to dissolve. And this is really what we've seen on the ZAD, that there is an attempt to break the rift between art and everyday life, between resisting the world and building new ones, between what is a home and what is a barricade, between what is work and what is pleasure, between what is life and what is activism. And that actually can take the shape of radical camembert made from disobedient and squatting cows. All that was made possible thanks to an extraordinary culture of resistance that was deployed by the entire movement. And what we call culture of resistance is the fact that not everyone is able to put themselves on the front line, not able, not willing to put themselves on the front line, but people can apply their skills and their capabilities to radical movements. And that was seen within this movement in the most flamboyant way. And so, for instance, when the troops withdrew, local farmers organized themselves so that they could take care of each other's farm and put their tractors around the hamlet, link the tractors together and put out a communique saying, if you attack again, you'll have to destroy our work tools. The farmers have been absolutely key to this movement. But it's not just them. It's also electricians that help the squatters pirate electricity to occupy buildings. It's cooks that provided banquets for hundreds of people of the movement. It's doctors that healed those that had been hurt during the violent eviction attempts. It's lawyers that gave their services for free. It's local residents that opened their garage to store stuff when people had been evicted. It's everyone doing basically what they can to maintain that culture of resistance. And it is really one of the key reasons why we came. It's because what we had been looking for so long, that is what we call the DNA of insurrection, which is the intertwining of the yes and the no, the creation and the resistance. Really what we found on the ZAD. And it's really important for us to bear the necessity of this enmeshing of the yes and the no, because however many community gardens we design or we built, or how many cooperative farms, cooperative wind farms we set up, if we don't dismantle the fossil fuel industries and the gross economy that supports them, then our gardens are likely to be underwater, and frankly, in the middle of spreading deserts, having clean energy becomes pretty useless. And we must learn from history, is that actually the fallout from the 60s, the utopian alternative movements that split from revolutionary movement, that split from the resistance, when the obsession was with building alternatives, actually gave way to the World Wide Web and Silicon Valley and the surveillance capitalism that has come out of it, because there's this desire to create communities of otherness, because of that separation, ended up working with and for the very military-industrial complex that they had been against decades earlier. And that's because they're separated. So it's really important to bear that in mind. All the while, the French government obviously continued to say that they would come and build the airport. And so with every announcement, the movement responded with extraordinary determination and creativity, putting thousands of bodies and bikes. This is the occupation of the large bridge that links the ZAD to the city of Nantes, where 20,000 people, 1,000 bikes and 500 tractors occupied it for an entire day. A month later, 60,000 people came partying on the motorways that surrounds the ZAD, and where the building of the airport would have started with the building of the access road. We also organized rituals that were disguised as demonstrations. And for instance, we called for people to come with walking sticks and plant them in the soil of Notre-Dame-des-Landes, making the pledge that they would come and pick them up if there were attacks. 40,000 people came and 25,000 sticks were planted, turning one of the hedgerows into the most fabulous porcupine. There were also acts of everyday magic, such as the building of a lighthouse that we can see from our window just now, and exactly where they wanted to put the control tower of the airport. And so on the 17th of January 2018, after more than 40 years of resistance, the airport was cancelled by the Prime Minister on live TV. And in the same breath, he also said that the illegals, i.e. all those who had come to the invitation of local residents, had to legalize themselves or be evicted or leave. A delegation of the movement produced a totally legally sound document and said to the government, if you sign this, you want us to be illegal, you sign this, we become legal and all is fine. The answer to this proposal came on the 5th of April at 3:20 in the morning.
Thank you.
It was an extraordinary, I mean, it was a mighty military operation that involved tanks, helicopters, thousands of cops. Within a matter of 3 days, 11,000 grenades, concussion grenades and tear gas grenades had been thrown at people that were defending life on the Bocage. And a third of the cabins of the ZAD were destroyed. For us, it makes no doubt that basically the movement had to be punished. It had to be punished because the government can deal with people saying no, demonstrating, even launching into confrontation to say no. What they cannot deal with is an entire movement that for several years and on a territory so vast is able to demonstrate and say, you're useless, you are irrelevant. And so that was the punishment for the ZAD and for the scandal that it represented. Against the violence of the eviction, we kept trying to rebuild again. And so this is an infrastructure that was rebuilt within 4 days and carried by hand over several kilometers across fields to replace the community hall that had been destroyed. It was destroyed immediately. And so the message was pretty clear. After 4 days, the local state representative declared a ceasefire and produced this simplified form that basically said, if you put your name, a single name with a single project and a plot of land associated with it, and you sign it, you will be able to stay. If you don't, you'll be evicted. We had 10 days. And that basically gave rise to the most fractious and deepest wounds that the movement probably had to face, because for quite a lot of people, this was absolutely intolerable blackmail and dishonorable surrender, which for quite a lot of us was obviously also the case. But the violence of the previous 4 days had convinced us that the government was prepared to go all the way. And for us, it was absolutely impossible to let go of the links that had been made there. Links that had been made to the landscape, to other humans, to other more than humans, to the commons that we had been building for years. And so we made a gamble. A number of us made a gamble. Hacked the form and said, okay, you want names, we'll give you names, but we're going to demonstrate to you what the commons are. And so it is not possible to respond with what you want, but we'll show you how under a name that is associated with a collective, there are various plots of land that are all intertwined, that are totally enmeshed, because this is how the commons work. It was a very thick, very complex folder that was handed in to the state services, so much so that they had to actually employ 5 people to be able to analyze them. And out of the 70 collectives that made up the ZAD at the time, 63 decided to take part in that gamble, 7 refused, and basically their homes were destroyed within a few days. So the message was very clear: you either sign or you get destroyed. And so this is where we are right now. The farmland has been secured through leases. Everything else is still in negotiation. We're still squatters of all the buildings, and we're still negotiating to make them accept and put into law what building a life in common and building the commons can be on a territory that is alive.
Isabelle Frémont, co-author of We Are Nature Defending Itself, Entangling Art, Activism, and Autonomous Zones, speaking at an event sponsored by the Reimagining Value Action Lab. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Frémont's co-author Jay Jordan also spoke at this event. Here, Jay talks about the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination, of which he and Isa are co-coordinators.
So what do we do in the lab? Basically, we bring artists and activists together to create new forms of disobedience. Basically, the idea is to design and then to deploy new forms of disobedience. keyword being deploy. There are a lot of artists who do a lot of designing of forms of disobedience, which often stay in the museums and the galleries and the theatres. And for us, the key is actually to deploy these things. So why do we bring artists and activists together? Basically, we believe that artists, and this is obviously a huge generalization, but that artists have a certain amount of creativity, a way of thinking outside of the box. They also can really bring the poetic or the metaphorical to things, but they also tend to have pretty big egos, tend to put their career in front of their politics, tend to have a lack of coherence between their political ideas and their ways of life, and not much courage sometimes. But what do activists have? Well, we think activists, and this is also a generalization, have a lot more courage, have normally a capacity to work collectively a bit better, normally have less big egos, although that's not always the case, but definitely have less space between their ways of life and their ideas. And unfortunately, have a lack of imagination quite often. Often it's the same toolbox of rebellion and resistance, the same actions, you know, the same, like, we're going to do a demonstration, we're going to do a blockade, we're going to do a riot, we're going to do a strike, we're going to write a pamphlet, we're going to do an assembly, we're going to do a camp. Basically, the toolbox is a bit small. So for us, the idea is basically to bring artists and activists together using the creativity of the artists and the courage of the activists, and create these forms. We do that within kind of pedagogic workshops where we teach horizontal decision making and then start to design the direct action. What is pretty key is that these are always done within the context of social movements, that we're entangled in social movements. We have one foot in the social movements and one foot in the cultural institutions, and it's super important for us. And the social movements we've been entangled with range from the climate camps, the summit mobilizations, and we always also work as organizers within those movements, not really making any difference between organizing and art.
And here, Jay Jordan talks about what happened at the UN Climate Change Conference in Paris in 2015, known as the COP21.
Paris, what do artists normally do, though? What do artists normally do around a COP, around something like the COP21 in Paris? Well, this is Olafsson Ellison and Minik Rosing, and they produced for that COP this project that was called Ice Watch. And basically, they brought huge blocks of ice from the Arctic and asked the citizens of Paris to watch them melt on the streets. This, for us, is a classic piece of what, in the book, we call extractivist art. Now, extractivism, I'm sure many of you here already know what it is, but it basically takes material from somewhere, transforms it into something else that gives value somewhere else. And that value is always more important than the continuation of life of the communities from which it's, that wealth is extracted. And we feel a lot of artistic practice does exactly this, taking value from one place for something else, which is normally the artist's career, the art world, the art institutions, the very idea of art. And this here is an extractive machine. It's the biggest extractivist machine in Europe. It's working probably right now. It works 24 hours a day. It's in Germany, and it takes the brown coal underneath communities. There are about 75 villages that have been already destroyed by this machine for the coal. And so in this situation, what do artists do? Well, you know, we're told by the IPCC scientists of the UN, not normally known for their radical pamphlet writing, that we've got 12 years, and they wrote this in 2018, that we have 12 years for rapid, far-reaching and unprecedented changes in all aspects of society. And for us at the lab, that means changing art. And the book talks very much about this. How do we change art within the capitalist scene? For us, it's not okay and it's not enough that to be an artist right now and to feel deeply that there are 200 species that are forced to extinction every day by the economy, and then make an installation about it, an installation that talks about, that reflects on. For us, this isn't enough. For us, art is not to show the world to people, but transform it together. So one of the chapters in the book is called 200 Years of Art and the World is Getting Worse. It's a nod to a beautiful book by James Hillman that's called 200 Years of Psychotherapy and the World is Getting Worse. And in that chapter, we basically talk about what Larry Shinner, our historian, calls the invention of art. And he basically says, art is an invention, it's a concept, and it came out of the colonial white European metropolis around 1750. But what else came around 1750 in Europe? Well, another invention, basically steam engines, the fossil fuel, fossil capital, the machines that enabled fossil capitalism to grow. Basically, all this stuff was invented around the same time as the invention of art. And so in a sense, art and fossil capital have the same extractivist logic embedded into them. But this strange three-letter word, this word art, most of you probably know that for most of human history and for most peoples on the world today, they don't have a word for art in the way we as European Westerners have this idea of art. It comes from the Greek techne and the Latin ars. And the irony is that even the Greeks didn't have a bloody word for art. In fact, for them, it meant any human activity. This could involve be horse breaking, shoemaking, verse writing, vase painting, governing, navigating. Any activity was seen as an art, not because it was done by artists, but because it was performed, and this is the key word, it was performed with grace. What is grace? Grace is an act of thinking with and thanking the world. It comes from the old French. It means thanks, as in grâce à, as in gratitude. And for us, what we call in the book an art of life should be an act, a gesture of thanking life for giving us life, an act of mutual reciprocity, an act that never separates ethics from aesthetics. And around 1750, in the white metropolis, as this idea, this invention of art evolves, you have these separations, massive separations of the modern, separation between genius and skill, a separation between the beautiful and useful, between art and craft, between culture and nature, and in the end, between art and life. And without these very violent rifts, all the ideals and practices and institutions that make up the art system that many of us might be part of, they would collapse without these violent rifts. And of course, this idea was pushed and it colonized our imagination, this invention of art. And ever since 1750, intellectuals, entrepreneurs, missionaries, armies have spread this invention and turned it into an unchallengeable universal. As Ariella Aishi Azule says, from the beginning, art has been one of imperialism's preferred terrain. Imperial violence is not secondary to art, but constitutive of it. And the book ends with a chapter entitled Life, where we talk about an art of life. I'm just going to read a tiny little bit of the last chapter. On the Bockage, we have become the territory because it engulfs and nourishes our imaginations and our bodies. We know when the frogs spawn and when the buckwheat is ready to mill. We sense when the potatoes will be harvested and celebrated with a French fries festival. We notice when it's been too dry and the ponds become lifeless. We care when the amphibians mate and the message on our phone reads, walk and drive carefully, it's the night of the fire salamanders. We're familiar with the weave of green lanes because we learned them whilst ambushing the police. By deserting the metropolis, we learned to pay attention and practice an art of life. But as our friend, the philosopher Isabel Stengers writes, the art of attention is not just giving ourselves to a thing's a priori defined as worthy of attention, but obliging us to, quote, imagine, to consult, to consider consequences involving connections between what we are accustomed to considering as separate, end of quote. Countless people now hold the picture of the Zad in their imaginations, like one might carry the memory of a work of art, an image that reminds us that we can all shape our worlds otherwise. On the Bockage, feelings and desire become form in the shape of a struggle that put life in common at its heart. To many, even though they would never term it thus, this land has become sacred because they sensed its wonder and risked and dedicated so much of themselves to ensure it never became an airport. Quote, "Nothing is made already sacred," end of quote, hermeticist and youth worker Orlando Bishop reminds us. Quote, "It becomes sacred when we give our attention to it at a level that reveals what it holds as energy and information." End of quote. When land becomes sacred, the struggle becomes art of everyday life, magic.
Jay Jordan speaking 6 weeks ago at an event to mark the publication of the new pamphlet, We Are Nature Defending Itself, Entangling Art, Activism, and Autonomous Zones. What Jay said there at the end, which was a bit muffled, was, when land becomes sacred and struggle becomes an art of everyday life, magic happens. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. The event also featured a question and answer period. Here the two authors, Isabelle Frémont and Jay Jordan, respond to a question about self-care, about how they stayed grounded and kept their spirits up over the course of the long struggle.
I think that one of the things that certainly keeps me going is the extraordinary texture of relationship that they are here, the solidarity that we've seen, and this the feeling that is very difficult to describe, to have been part of something that is absolutely extraordinary. And to, it still happens to me very regularly that even people that really, really infuriate me in some situations, I just have to remember that, you know, I just have to look at the forest that is still there, that is still standing, that is, you know, I just look at the hedgerows and look back at these people that, you know, however infuriating, have been part of this struggle, and that all this is still standing thanks to what we've built together. This is something that really, really helps. That's one part. And one of the things that we've also started doing in collaboration with another art collective is a collective called the CAR, the Cellule d'Action Rituelle, the Ritualistic Action Cell. And we basically started to organize and propose rituals at key dates of the history of the struggle, but also to celebrate the passing of seasons and to really to find another way to connect us to the land and to each other. And this has been really, I find, a part of some sort of healing process.
The importance, I think, for me has been to also have a kind of what some people would describe as a spiritual practice that involves meditation and rituals and magic, and to have that as a regular practice. That is something I learned from ULEX, which is an incredible educational space in Catalonia, which looks at questions of regenerative activism and does a lot of work against burnout. And what I learned very beautifully from there was really also that, you know, I realized as an activist having a massive burnout in 2017 that for 25 years I'd actually put my political desires in front of my personal needs most of the time. And so what we learned really beautifully there was how, you know, how do you actually balance what your needs are, personal needs are, with your political action and desires. And we've been so inspired by that work that ULEX has been doing for many years that we're going to try and translate that here on the ZAD through an education project and working with a group, an amazing group here that's called Soin Soin, which means care, which is doing, has spent a year doing a survey of everyone on the ZAD and looking at their needs for healing and health.
Isa and Jay were also asked about the extent to which cartography or map-making aided the struggle to defeat the airport construction project.
Cartography and mapping has been a really, really important tool on the ZAD for many years. There was actually a cartography group that was set up, and interestingly, it really links to this notion of culture of resistance, because there was someone who was working for the city of Nantes who had access to very, very specific types of software to be able to do really complex mapping. And she came with that access and taught people, and there are quite a few architects here who are dissident architects that live on the ZAD, and actually did a lot of using mapping and cartography as tools of disobedience. So they were being able to actually see the various layers, because one of the really fascinating things about apprehending a territory as commons is to reappropriate the multiple layers of usage that then land is about. And that was really clearly expressed through loads and loads of maps. It was also they were also really extraordinary tools of defiance, because they really helped us go to negotiate with the state, with having, you know, the maps of all the owners, the maps of all the people that were renting, all the maps of the various farmers, and it's like, and it really helped this notion that we knew this territory so much better than they did. So, and one of the things that, for instance, in the welcome space that is at La Rolandière, there is a gigantic map, and it's a really useful tool also for people to get a sense of the vastness of the territory, and seeing all those points with all the cabins and the collectives, and so it's also very much a tool to get more of a sense and a texture of what the territory is like.
We even used mapping, actually. So during all the eviction threats, we worked with a cartography group, because we did a big training where we trained 1,000 people over 8 weekends to defend the land using a kind of orientation game things, and using the pirate radio station and walkie-talkies and so on, and teaching affinity group work and so on. And we produced this special map, which was called the ZAD Atlas, and it was made special size so it could go into your pocket, and so it wouldn't get wet in the mud and the tear gas and so on. And basically it was a very detailed map of the blockage in case of eviction. So it would show places, it would also show key intersections which would need to be blocked to stop the troops coming in, i.e. where barricades could be built and so on. So that was another very useful bit of mapping, and it had the kind of information about legal staff and so on in it, and the medical staff and so on in it. So that was also a different, another special kind of more hands-on mapping for the territory defense.
Another question posed to Isa and Jay was about the process for adding or incorporating new residents into the ZAD, and about other land-based occupations that challenge capitalist initiatives.
It's interesting, because it's like, I think that people who are inspired are very much invited to come and spend time here. It's like it's still less than before, but we still have some people who turn up for the first time and say, "Oh, I've seen the story of the ZAD and absolutely want to live here." And the advice is always the same. It's like, spend some time first and we'll see, you know. It's like, let's actually experiment life together before deciding that this is what we want. It's really important. There are processes that are partly informal and partly formal. We don't have yet very, very formal processes for people to be to come and live here. I mean, it's starting to be put in place, and it's very much about finding ways to integrate into the life in common and commons buildings, It's very often by integrating a collective and finding projects to get involved in. And if there are other, there have been quite a lot of land-based occupations that actually took the name ZAD in France. And a few have actually also won. It's like there is a center parks that was supposed to destroy, I think it was 40 hectares of forest that was defeated, and partly also through an occupation of the forest linked exactly like the ZAD to a movement that had loads of other tactics, including legal procedures and very minutious attacks. It's like, I'm not sure that there is a formal network, but certainly the ZAD here really tries to be a point of connection. And so there are various events that are being organized very regularly for this kind of struggle to come and meet and exchange and nourish each other. I don't know of a formal network, but here is certainly one of the nodes of the network.
Isabelle Frémont and Jay Jordan talking about their new pamphlet, We Are Nature Defending Itself, Entangling Art, Activism, and Autonomous Zones, published by Pluto Press as part of its Vagabond series, edited by Max Haven. The book was published in collaboration with the Journal of Aesthetics and Protest. Frémont and Jordan co-coordinate the Laboratory of Insurrectionary Imagination. We've put links to the pamphlet and to the lab on our website, againstthegrain.org. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.